gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker, right here on June the 3rd, 2015, Wotan's Day, dedicated to David Lane, murdered by the federal people in the prison right here in Terre Haute, Indiana. And we're at P.O. Box 401, of course, and that's where you send your donations for the radio show and donations for other projects, if you please. Then go up to resist.com, our giant website, and get educated. Man, I'm telling you, if you can't get educated on that website, then you're too dumb to come along. Yeah, right. Oh, you know, some people get richer and others get poorer. Most people get more poor all the time. And some people, you know, just by the sweat of their brow, of course, and the fact that usually they're Jewish, get richer and richer. Let's listen to this, okay?
A bird's eye view of a Los Angeles mega mansion in construction. Asking price, $500 million, and a U.S. record, says famed developer Nile Naimi. Artist renditions imagine the finished complex, one of the latest in a series of new luxury homes now on the market around the world. While we can't access the LA construction site nearby, this is a property we can. 25 acres on a Bel Air hilltop owned by billionaire Jeff Green. This is currently the most expensive residential listed property in the country. Welcome to Palazzo di Amore. Its listing price is $195 million, and this is Joyce Ray. And you're going to take me on a tour.
I certainly am. 2010, I closed the highest sale in the United States, and that was at $50 million in 2010. Now we're seeing many sales at $100 million.
On our tour, the music room is first.
Isn't this spectacular?
Wow. This is three times the size of my apartment. This is one of the family rooms. There's a mini Versailles in the backyard, and next to it, a vineyard. And to enjoy that wine...
This is the upstairs wine tasting and wine cellar. This is my favorite, Cabernet.
Meantime, a larger one downstairs that holds much more. There's also the formal dining room and a two-story entertainment complex.
Well, you get the point, boys and girls. Some people are building $500 million houses, $150 million houses, $150 million houses, $50 million houses. And you, you have a hard time holding on to your little wood frame house. See, that's what we're moving towards in this country. In fact, we're there. This is the super rich, the people that decide what your life's going to be like. And most of them are people who have bought their citizenship, come from other countries. The one who's building a $500 million house that was on here earlier, he's a Jew, and his wife is a hot Asian gal, Chinese probably. So how long do you think this is going to go before the lid blows off? Well, I think it can go quite a while, but the lid will at some point blow off, and because it's just the way nature works. You know, our government, in all their intelligence and wise reactions, the USS Forrestal was a carrier that the taxpayers paid $2 billion for. It holds 3,500 men. And a few years ago, it had somebody screwed up and a rocket blew up on the damn thing and damaged it quite a bit. Well, they wrote it off for scrap. And guess what? The Naval Department sold that aircraft carrier for one penny to the scrap dealers. One penny. Now, do you know what the big scrap people can do with something like that? An aircraft carrier? They're going to make tremendous amounts of money with the metal off that, and I'll bet that aircraft carrier ends up in China or someplace. So that's another thing to think about. How little they care about your tax money. Of course, we've known that for decades, haven't we? You know, in movies and advertisements, break-ins occur during the dead of night with the darkness of a cover. A burglar covertly enters a home. Most people believe this to be true, but the majority of burglaries actually occur during the day. In fact, over 40% of break-ins occur during the day, typically during business hours. Another myth is that you will be home during a break-in. Thankfully, that is not the case. Burglars do not want to meet people when they enter a home. They want as little trouble as possible. The average burglary is only 8 minutes. There you go. Just a minute here. Losing my place. Now, it's common belief that burglars break in through a window. Doors are actually the most common point of entry. 60% of burglaries occur through a door. The most common entry point is the front door. So if you're going to have a strong door, put it on your front door. In Fallbrook, California, I had a steel front door. And believe me, nothing could get through that unless it was a charge of dynamite. 36% of break-ins through a door happen because the door is left open or unlocked. Make sure always to lock your door behind you, but Tommy says, if you've got lots of windows in your house, it don't make much difference because they don't need to come through the door. When windows are the entry point to a home, the window pane is the most often broken. 61% of window break-ins include breaking glass. Glass break sensors are an important layer of protection for your home. Despite common perception, it's unlikely a break-in will happen through a basement or a garage. Only 4% and 9% occurring through their respectfully. What is the most often stolen? Well, if you were going to protect one valuable in your house, what item would you select? Most people would protect their appliances. The truth is that electronics are the most commonly stolen items. When designing your home security system, make sure to place sensors in the room where your TV and your computer, and in rooms with other items you wish to protect. Entry sensors have many functions, including protecting your electronics. Many people assume that firearms are one of the most common items stolen, but truth is that firearms are only stolen 2% of the time. One of the most important elements to your home security is layered protection. A security alarm system is a great tool to your home protection. When you're arming your home against break-ins, make sure to know the facts and you'll be as safe as houses. So anyhow, that's that for today, your report on safety from burglars, usually niggeroos. But I still make it very important point to have video recording equipment and audio recording equipment covering your house. That's not going to probably stop the initial burglary, but it will help you identify who the burglar was. And of course, most burglars that do it all the time have a rap sheet and their pictures on file with the police department. So anyhow, I know I've used it for years. I've never had any big problem with burglary, but I've had attack problems on my property for political reasons. And when I had video of what happened, I could get some kind of payback, if you get what I mean. One thing I like to stress is if you get hit with a burglary, there's not much you're going to do about it, unless you've got the faces on tape. But the first thing you do is usually people call the cops. Well, that's a no-no for politically active people like yourself and myself, lone wolves, because that's the beautiful opportunity cops use to look over what's in your house, what's all over your house. They'll want to come in, they want to look in all the rooms, they want to look, and they look around and see anything laying on a table or anything that's a clue, not of who the burglar was, but what you might be up to that they can charge you with. So if the stuff's gone and there's no chance of getting it back, you just have to bite the bullet. But I've had a few times when I've had a problem, I didn't call the cops because I knew they just want to come into the house and nose around. And that's something. A lot of people get arrested because when the cops come in to supposedly find out about the burglary, they're looking for anything illegal they can get you for, especially drugs. People are arrested all the time on that kind of a thing. So that's why you don't let cops come in your house. They say, can we come in? No, you can't come in. If you don't have a warrant, you can't come in. And if you stick with that, you're going to be safer. Well, the enemy is bragging that they have killed more than 10,000 ISIS jihadists by airstrikes. And they think that's a big deal, but there's 10,000 more to replace them every month. Maybe 20,000. So this idea that through airstrikes you're going to beat ISIS, a guerrilla force, a fanatic guerrilla force, no way.
Ahead of China's interview with U.S. President Barack Obama on Tuesday night, Alana Dan of the UBDA TV show interviewed some of the closest advisors to Obama to paint a wider picture of the president ahead of his TV interview. How Obama views himself as being the closest thing to a Jew remains a baffling source of mystery. It would appear he may have somehow felt that being the son of a Kenyan man connects him to all minority communities in the U.S., including the Jewish community. Dan also interviewed Martin Indyk, who was tasked as the U.S. Special Envoy during peace talks that were torpedoed by the Palestinian Authority, PA, last April, and who has gone on record bashing Israel on numerous occasions. Indics claim that Obama will guarantee Israel's security was disproved in last summer's war against Hamas terrorists, as Obama canceled a routine shipment of Hellfire missiles. U.S. President Barack Obama's 16-year-old daughter Malia has attracted unsolicited attention from Kenya, where the president's father was from, as one intrepid Kenyan lawyer on Tuesday offered a motley selection of livestock to marry the teenager. The lawyer, Felix Kuprono, of the Kalenjin tribe, said he would pay Obama 50 cows, 70 sheep and 30 goats to marry his daughter, reports AFP. Kuprono told the Nairobian that he got interested in her in 2008, when Obama was making his first presidential campaign and Malia was a tender 10 years of age. Kuprono said he will present Obama with his offer and is full of hope that the president will bring Malia with him when he makes his first presidential visit to Kenya in July. As far away as the life of a Kalenjin woman may seem to the daughter of the American president, traditional Kenyan life actually isn't that remote to the Obamas.
One cool tactic, I get a mic around here. One cool tactic of ISIS is they're beginning to dam up some of the rivers, artificial dams, to and closing the floodgates or opening the floodgates to control the water downstream. This is an interesting guerrilla tactic, and guerrilla tactics many times use tactics on the cheap. And I had the information here, but I can't find it right now, what they're doing. But it's causing a lot of problems for people over there. So Obama says, I'm the closest thing to a Jew in the Oval Office. Well, you don't have to be a Jew to serve the interests of Jews. In fact, the people who serve the Jews the most are not Jews, Christians and so forth. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is the way the Chinese like to spend their money. They got so much of our money. Of course, they're investing millions and millions and hundreds of millions to build in South America, which is the money that came from the deported job market and the deported industry that we sent to China. So all of this tremendous amounts of money they're dropping around the world are simply off the back of the American workers. It didn't hurt the super rich at all. In fact, it made them richer. But here's something to think about. Something else that the Chinese invest their money in. A popular Japanese porn star has quit the business to become a mysterious Chinese billionaire's personal assistant, according to reports. Her salary, $8 million, or 1 billion yen, for an exclusive 15-year contract. Rola Mosaki, 22, signed a monolopy deal with an unnamed businessman in the entertainment industry, the Tokyo Reporter said. Oh boy. The porno actress, who is also known as Rala Takazawa, is half Japanese and half Russian. She don't look Japanese to me, the picture. She is becoming increasingly popular in Japan and China since debuting in 2012. The couple reportedly appeared together recently in Beijing holding hands. He wore a mask. The nature of her personal assistant duties was not explained. I wonder what that would be. I wonder, is she a good stenographer? Is she good on the computer? Or is she good at something else? Well, cops will be cops. Boys will be boys. Indian cops, that's in India, raped a model inside the police station. Three Indian cops raped a model inside a Mumbai police station. We're trying to get her to pay $7,800 to get out of jail. Two assistant inspectors and a constable were arrested on rape and sexual harassment charges Wednesday after the 29-year-old model reported the April 3rd attack, Indian newspapers Midday reported. Wonder how often that happens in this country. I think quite a bit. Supposedly, a Russian agency employs hundreds of trolls to wreak havoc on the internet. bolster support for the Kremlin and spread panic in the U.S., according to a report. The Internet Research Agency creates hundreds of online personas that support the Russian government and burn the Obama administration. Though the purpose of the agency, like its dealings, are shady, the IRA has been linked to hundreds of social media accounts that claim fake U.S. disasters are occurring. A chemical leak in Louisiana, an Ebola outbreak in Atlanta, and a fatal police shooting of an unarmed black woman. Quote, I can't say that clearly explain to you what your purpose there is, former employee Ludmila Shavluchuk said, but they created such an atmosphere that people would understand that they were doing something important and secretive at a very high pay. In Russia, the trolls create the appearance of Vladimir Putin has an army of supporters, the Times said. Let me see here. Let me get some more of this. Employees in an average St. Petersburg office are instructed to slam Putin's opposition and claim glory for Putin through fake accounts and hundreds of posts. They write optimistically about domestic problems like the fall of the ruble and say nasty things about Ukrainians as the conflict between the countries rages on. One account, run by Savachuk, documented the musings of a fortune teller named Kantdora, who gleaned insight about geopolitics from the spirit world. In America, the IRA's mission appears to be slightly different. The agency spreads anti-Obama sentiments with fake accounts like, I am ass-waxing on about Obama's perceived faults. Some accounts spread more as just opinions. On September 11, 2014, hundreds of troll Twitter accounts claimed to witness a chemical leak in St. Mary's Parish, Louisiana. They posted news articles supposedly from websites like CNN and other news outlets. Some residents got text messages telling them to seek shelter. The chemical leak, claiming to emanate from the non-existent company called Colombian Chemicals, never happened. The news articles were fake and taken from cloned websites. While the IRA's simultaneous tries to bolster support for the government through social media, it tries to discredit online discourse. Only about half of Russians have access to the Internet, on which the opposition can spread its message most easily. The report implies that the IRA wants to turn people off from the Internet so they won't be exposed to the voice of the opposition. The point is to spoil it, to create the atmosphere of hate, to make it so stinky that normal people won't want to touch it. The link between the IRA, and this is not the Irish IRA, it's this Russian outfit, and the government is unclear, but local outlets reported that the agency was funded by Putin's buddy, Evgeny Prigozhin, an oligarch. That's one of these rich capitalist guys. And representatives of his holding company, Concord, did not respond to requests for comment. A domain associated with the IRA has registered in the Mikhail Berchik, a tech entrepreneur who was named as the agency's executive director in documents leaked by hackers. Berchik claimed he did not remember purchasing the domain and suggested a different person with the same name headed the agency. Now, this is one thing I want to get across to you. That's why I get in more and more trouble, of course, with the right wing. They're very quick to jump on a foreign leader as being the salvation of our problem. And many in this country have said that is Putin. Well, I said early on, you don't trust anybody with that kind of power, and I don't trust Putin for sure. There's things that he has done and things behind him. And being from the KGB is enough for me right off. And for these some of these Americans to go over there and having these meetings, they're simply going to use it for propaganda against the U.S. Now, we know how we feel about Obama, and we don't have to go on and on about that. But on the other hand, don't jump from the frying pan into the fire of supporting foreign leaders who their methods and goals are not to the best interests of the people and the working class of the United States. So I would be very reticent to attend any kind of these kind of things like I read about yesterday, because number one, they're going nowhere unless they're manipulated into a false flag situation to go there. And I just don't see any future in that. Plus, they have no power anyhow, and they're not going to get the power. They're too fractionalized. They're trying to put too many ideologies into the same boat, and the boat's going to sink or never even get off the beach. So be very careful who you choose as your great leader in the struggle. You take care of your own business, your lone wolf business, your own private situation, and don't get sucked in like a lot of these. You know, 100 Frenchmen have died fighting for ISIS. Well, I don't believe in fighting for any of these outfits, including the United States military. So don't join up with any of these kind of people, no matter who they represent. Well, let's see here. Let's go back in the archives way back here to Liberty Bell magazine, of which we have a large collection of Liberty Bell magazine that was published by George Dietz. He's long gone now. He used to be a real estate man down in West Virginia. But he wrote, and he had a lot of writers writing for him. They did a good job. My good friend Revelo P. Oliver wrote for this magazine. And I think Revelo P. Oliver was the greatest intellect of the racial struggle. He started out in the John Birch Society like I did, and he got sick of it, and he quit the John Birch Society like a lot of other people did. We came in, we were there for a few years, and then we went on. This is Revelo P. Oliver in 1987, December. I've just received by airmail the latest issue of Volume 13, Number 7 of the valuable little periodical News of the New World, published in South Africa, P.O. Box 830, Honeydew. It is printed in a reduced and less expensive format because, as the editor explains, the support it receives from South Africans has sadly diminished recently after the elections, which maintained in power the government which, under Jewish control, is betraying the Aryan population of South Africa to their implacable enemies. An analysis of the deadly illusions induced in the minds of the majority of South Africans was reprinted from the News of the New World in Liberty Bell in 1986. The present issue begins with the recognition that Aryans of South Africa are suffering from a form of mental disability, a disability which has the same effect as an hallucinatory drug. It makes otherwise intelligent and educated people live in an illusory world that does not exist and has never existed, unquote. Prudent reasons prevent the author from identifying the cause of this hallucinatory drug called Christianity, to which our race has been addicted for 15 centuries. But he does state bluntly some fundamental truths on which we have long insisted in these pages. Quote, victims of peaceitis loudly proclaim that they can't depend on force. Actually, you can't depend on anything but force. Diplomacy works only if it's backed up by force. Diplomacy itself is about force, the threat of it, the use of it, and the direction of it. Peace is nothing but the aftermath of war or the interlude between wars. War or the threat of war is what makes peace, or else there is no peace. These considerations lead to the irrefragable conclusion that the editor was probably italicized. Quote, whether people like us or hate us is irrelevant. Our choice is to be feared or to be the victim. There is no other choice. That is a clear statement of reality in this world, and you may use it as a criterion. If the person who hears it squawks, he is either a peddler or an addict of the hallucinatory drug that is driving Aryans to mass suicide. What the drug has done to our race in South Africa and is now doing here is an apparent from the concluding paragraphs of the article. Quote, if some white South Africans wish to ignore the lessons of history and of daily life in Africa and subject themselves to black rule, that is their business. They apparently do so wish and have made it abundantly clear at the polls that they do. They are adults. On their own heads be it. Yet we have a responsibility to our children who trust us to subject them to the mental, moral, and physical degradation in store for them is an act of such appalling cruelty as to be almost unbelievable. And you can see by this, even way back then, they knew what was coming in South Africa. But they had the same problem we have here. These people are dead in the brain. Quote, here we have an instance of an intelligent body of people so bemused by egalitarian propaganda that they willingly condemn their own children to destruction. For this monstrous crime, they fully deserve the racial extinction which will inevitably come with black rule, yet one pities the innocent children. That is the epitaph of South Africans and will be the epitaph for Americans. I cannot but reflect with wonder and terror in the fact that when I was a child, Americans were wont to shudder at the heartless cruelty of Semites and their religion, which they saw most vividly exhibited in the pages of Flaubert's Salammbô, which depicted the Carthaginians at a time of crisis and national peril so great that they tried to placate their ferocious god by throwing their own infant children into the raging flames of a furnace. And now we must confess that those Semites were far less heartless than our Aryans today. The Carthaginians sacrificed only infants and children, so young that their consciousness was not fully developed. They sacrificed them in a way that put the victims almost instantly out of their misery. They sacrificed only a few score of their children, not all of them, and they sacrificed those few children only to panic at a time when the nation faced a dire peril that menaced its very existence, not in idiotic complacency and smug self-satisfaction, when they were a world power and could have triumphed over their enemies quickly and easily, but insanely took pride in not defending themselves or the children they sadistically doomed to degradation and a tormented death. A writer in Liberty Bell magazine, March 1982, called us the damned race. He was right. Now we'll move on to a little bit another article that was written back in 87. I have commented often enough in these pages on the putrefaction of what was once were institutions of higher learning in the United States and Europe. I shall here quote two paragraphs from a publication of an organization called Accuracy in Academia, of which the mailing address is blah, 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 District of Corruption. Quote, at Miami-Dade Community College, one of the largest colleges in the country, we zeroed in on a professor, race unstated, who told his students outrageous lies. He was recorded on tape telling his class that Washington died of pneumonia, caught when he jumped from a bedroom window into a snowbank to escape an irate husband. The professor tells the class that Washington would have died of syphilis if he had not contracted pneumonia. When Accuracy in Academia interviewed the professor, he denied making such statements until informed that they had been tape recorded. He then quickly terminated the interview. At the State University of New York, Farmingdale, a student who dared challenge the inaccurate statements by a philosophy professor, race unstated, was thrown out of the class and was subsequently arrested by campus security officers for standing up for his rights. A court ordered university to readmit him, and Accuracy in Academia raised funds to pay the legal costs of his defense against the outrageous charges lodged against him. In the second quotation, I have italicized the clause that shows the rottenness of the whole institution and precludes the racketeers who run it from claiming, as they are doubtless like to do, that they are unknowingly harbored an errant liar in their faculty. When Hercules was given the seemingly impossible task of mucking out the stables of King August, had neglected for years, he diverted two rivers and let these torrents wash away the mounds of accumulated filth. I do not know where the directors of the accuracy of media can find rivers big enough for the task they have assumed, but I wish them luck. Yeah, that's right. Now let's move on to a little article here by Revlo P. Oliver. The Evils of Fascism. In 1936, the Judeo-Communist apparatus in Spain, having obtained control of the government in corrupt elections, began a great modernization of the country, celebrating it with massacres of Spaniards of cultivation and refinement. Although the atrocities that were given publicity in the United States were almost confined to the burning of churches, the torture and murder of priests, and the rape and mutilation and murder of nuns. The sweet smell of fresh blood always quickens the ideals of liberal intellectuals who rejoiced in the expectation that all the glories of the Jewish capture of the Russian Empire in 1917 and 18 were about to be repeated. They howled and gnashed their teeth when the Spanish army began what was technically a revolt against the communist government. And in American universities, they incited hot-headed young dolts to rush to Spain and enlist in the indispensable shock troops that they were called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, having been given, not inappropriately, the name of the backwoods politician who precipitated the great catastrophe that rescinded the Constitution and ended the American Republic. You see these guys on TV every once in a while meet. Most of them are about 90 years old now, and most of them were Jews that ran over there to Spain to protect their so-called revolution. After the death of the three senior generals, command of the Spanish army devolved on General Francisco Franco, who won the Civil War, suppressed the Judeo-Communist rabble, and with the help of the sane political organization in Spain, the Falange, gave the nation a stable and civilized government. Franco was only 47 when he established his fascist regime in Spain. He was a competent general, but he lacked political genius. There are some uncertainties about his genealogy, and it's said that he was sincerely a practicing Catholic. His first concordant with the Vatican gave him control over the appointment of bishops in Spain, but the church, strange as it may seem, after the atrocities of the Judeo-Communists, set out to covertly to undermine the government that had saved it from liquidation. Christianity is a lethal disease of nations, become most virulent in this century. The members of the Falange were rational men who did not wear out the knees of their trousers in genuflection before the shrines of mythical gods, and professional salvation hucksters were naturally hostile to beliefs that limited their racket. They were soon helped by the CIA, which has ultimately access to the pockets of the American taxpayers, and which financed a stridently religious pack of superstitious hallucinations and nitwits called the Opus Dei to do Yahweh's dirty work. The godly folk with the capacity for dissimulation and the torturous intrigue that goes with their faith prevailed upon Franco steadily to reduce the influence of the Falange and replace it with the pious shysters and traitors. In the end, the old man seems to have permitted, if he did not sanction, a surreptitious persecution of the Falange by a typically sleazy and clandestine conspiracy. Professor Antonio Tovar, who probably was the most distinguished scholar in Spain, was driven from the University of Salamanca, in which he had long been catedratico, with the impressionable tenure. and of which he was at the time the rector, in keeping with the European Academic Organization, after lending distinction to universities in Argentina and the United States, he accepted a professorship at Tübingen, where he died a few years ago. In 1947, Franco, despite the misgivings of the Falange, declared Spain a monarchy, which a yet unnamed king was to rule after his death. And in 1966, Franco sponsored an organic law that was designed to reduce the Falange to political impotence and introduce the whole panoply of essentially liberal innovations in preparations for a constitutional monarchy. He selected as his heir, the Bourbon, who became King of Spain in 1975 as Juan Carlos I. A weak young man who lacked the will and probably the wish to resist further liberalization of the nation, of which he was content to be decorative figurehead. Conditions in Spain deteriorated in Franco's old age and piousness, but only slowly and gradually, for the forces of destruction were held in check by a salutary memory of the power of the Spanish fascism in its prime. At his death, the dike broke. Under the Playboy King, democratic elections were held in 1976, and Spain began to race down the road to hell that the Jews paved to lead the nations of Western civilizations to the abyss. September issue of Spearhead was a British magazine, gives a few statistics that prove how rapidly the evils of fascism are being overcome in Spain. In the year preceding the elections of 1976, there were 3,660 reported robberies in Spain. In 1986, there were 49,423. And you may feel assured that further progress towards social justice will henceforth be made every year. In Madrid alone, there were 40,000 known addicts to heroin, and the educational system is functioning with American efficiency. A typical Spanish boy starting to sniff glue for kicks at school when he was 10. He graduated to marijuana when he was 12 or 13, and by the time he was 17, he was giving himself hypodermics of heroin. There is no estimate of the number of Spaniards addicted to cocaine, which is by far the most popular narcotic in Mediterranean countries because it acts as an aphrodisiac. The newspapers, most of them controlled by God's race, regularly carried advertisements by homosexuals seeking dates with fellow perverts. A British lecturer noted that one class dinner there were present 80 young Spanish women, all 23 years of age. Not one was married. He had no means of knowing how many had had abortions or born bastards. The crimes of violence by both individuals and gangs are rapidly increasing, and the tourists on whom the country depends for a substantial part of its revenue now have as good a chance of being mugged and robbed or abused as they would have in Chicago or London, model cities of the oligarchy that is called democracy. And of course, you know, Spain has gone right down the path with this Euro government, which was, once the Euro government was in Europe, it was all over for Europe, at least from our point of view. The Spearhead magazine did not mention that Spaniards are fulfilling their Christian duty to fill their country with niggers and several varieties of biological refuse from the Near and Middle East that are collectively called WOGs. Diseased mongrels are being bred to replace Spaniards, and the invaders are bringing with them the African plague, commonly called AIDS, which will give white Spaniards an opportunity to prove pathologically that they are too high-minded and imbecile to discriminate. English and American tourists should feel at home in Spain now. They will no longer miss the stench of their own countries. Nasty fascism is a thing of the past, and democratic progress is being made everywhere. If you are what Kikes call a neo-Nazi and do not rejoice in an oligarchy, you may reflect that there is one good thing about all democracies, even less depraved ones. The case for opportunism optimism about democracy was well stated by John Adams, who succeeded George Washington as the president of the American Republic. Democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes itself, exhausts and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. And that was from Madison. The September issue of Spearhead comments on the appointment of new Chief Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police, who will hold what may be the most strategic office in Britain. The Chief Commissioner not only governs with virtual autocratic authority the police who maintain order in the capital city, but it sets the standards for all the police forces in Britain, which look up to the Metropolitan Police as the archetype of exemplary organization, while promotion to London is the acme of every provincial officer's ambition. And as all readers of detective stories know, the Chief Commissioner is the ruler of Scotland Yard, the most famous detective organization in the world, from which the police of all the countries of England regularly borrow experts to solve mysteries of which the solution does not quickly become obvious. And every visitor to the British Isles in the age that ended with the suicide of Europe was impressed by the efficiency and courtesy of the organization created by Sir Robert Peel in 1829 and justly admired and envied by the rest of the civilized world. Since the new commissioner will distribute the honors, promotions, and emoluments that are the rewards of service in the police, it is obvious that he can, within a few years, completely remodel and transform the enforcement of law throughout England and even Ulster and Scotland. The new commissioner is a person named Peter Imbert, who, to judge from the photographs, is white, possibly Anglo-Saxon, and male. Spearhead disclosed the qualifications that entitled Imbert to his high position. In 1984, he was chief constable of the Thames Valley Police. He shamelessly confessed, quote, "There are six black faces in my family. My wife's sister and my niece married colored men and are raising multiracial families. Our society is changing from white, middle-class stereotypes that my generation grew up with, and I welcome the change," unquote. The word stereotype suffices to show the operations of the degenerate's mind. It is a favorite in the patter of liberal intellectuals, most of whom have no notion of how stereotypes were made, but all of whom are inspired by beatific visions of a future in which the planet will swarm with diseased and mindless mongrels living as happily as rats in the sewers of old Paris. Just before he entered the office, the loathsome traitor to his nation and race announced that racial attackers, by which he meant the lowly Anglo-Saxons, so bigoted that they are just jostle on the streets any vermin that they are overrunning England, would be charged by assault by Scotland Yard and arrested, even if the victim shows no sign of injury, because disrespect shown a nigger or a wog creates stress in the dear creature's delicately attuned psyche. Imbert has even announced that in London, where the vermin are mugging, robbing, beating, and even murdering white men and women, and raping white women and children with ever-increasing impunity, the first priority of the Metropolitan Police will be that of stamping out racial abuse and putting in their place Englishmen who are not humbly grateful for the privilege of being molested, mauled, and kicked around by filthy, savage anthropoids to whom they are giving their island. Furthermore, the racial taunts are now legally crimes in England and subject to punishment by 5 years in prison. So if you injudiciously visit the old multiracial sewer that was once a civilized nation and the cynosure of the white world, and you enter a British pub, be careful. Some of the usuals, as habitues of taverns are called, are sure to be disguised chief inspectors from Scotland Yard, eavesdropping on conversations in the hope of trapping some dastardly criminal in the very act, flagrant delicto, of making an unkind or possibly pejorative remark about the noble niggers or worshipful wogs. And if, as is likely, you are mugged, beaten, and perhaps mutilated as you leave the pub, be prudent and don't let the police hear you complain, for that might lead to a criminal charge that you disapprove of civil rights for rodents. In the same issue, the editor of the periodical reports with prudent caution, for he has spent months in prison for the crime of believing that Englishmen still had a country of their own. An item of news that seems to have been overlooked by friends who send me cuttings from the British press. Quote, "We even have a Crown Court judge, race unstated, on record as saying that the theory that the Holocaust never happened is one that cannot be tolerated in our society," unquote. We are not told whether the eminent jurist thought that the drawing and quartering would be sufficient punishment of the crime of doubting any hoax that the predatory race wants to impose on its dupes. This in a country inhabited by the epigony of a nation that remembered its Magna Carta and boasts of its intellectual freedom since the time of Mary's frantic effort to reimpose the Roman Catholicism by pseudo-legal terrorism. This issue of the Spearhead went to press a few days too early. It reports the appearance of a nigger named Richard Grant Stokes in the ranks of Britain's most honored and elite soldiers, the Guard, whose duty it is to protect the monarch. The creature was inducted into the Guard after his disorderly insubordination while in training was overlooked, since it would have been unjust to apply to Neanderthals the standards that are enforced against Englishmen. And the British press was filled with Yiddish hosanna as it proudly displayed photographs of the ape standing as a black spot on the ranks of the handsome young Englishmen, who no doubt were concealing with the iron discipline for which the Guard is famous the sickness in their stomach. The magazine just missed the news that a few days after this animated jewel of multiracial Britain went on duty in the Guard, he, with dexterity and morality, for which his race is famous, pinched the wallet of a tourist. For this exercise of his civil rights, the dear nigger will be punished by being relieved of duty for a few days and given a reprimand. It is still thought expedient, you see, to placate racial bigots in England occasionally until Scotland Yard has taught them their place in the world. It is admitted that the elite pickpocket is the protege of Prince Charles, who shoved him into the Guard and is acting to spare his dear favorite the drastic punishment that would have been inflicted on a Briton guilty of the same offense. Prince Charles, called the Clown Prince of Wales by some Englishmen who retain a sense of decency, is part Jewish degenerate, who likes to be photographed dancing with niggers, female, in the published pictures, and who is heir apparent to the new tinsel throne of Great Britain. Some Anglo-Saxons do not look forward with joy to the reign of King Charles III, or will it be David I, and retaining their traditional optimism, meditate on the fact that the prince's favorite body servant recently died of AIDS. Such is England's progress to the abyss. More than two decades ago, I commented on one of the most terrible tragedies of all recorded history, the ghastly process that in less than a century reduced Britain in a great nation and rulers of an empire on which the sun never set to a herd of frightened sheep huddling together on a little island on which the sun will soon set for the last time and night must fall. That's the end of that reading. You know, Revelo P. Oliver, along with being the leading intellectual ever of this racial struggle, was also able to speak in straight English about niggers and stuff. He always used the word nigger and used many other epithets to describe these beasts of the field. So I'm going to read a lot more of these because I have a whole library full of them, and luckily I have transferred all these Liberty Bell magazines for some time to Wall Street, and he transcribed them, and they're up on the internet. I'm not sure whether they're on our internet webpage or not. I'll have to check. I get behind. So anyhow, if you like these readings, I'm going to do a lot more of them because he was right all along, and he was dead on, I'll tell you that. Well, that's the end of the show for today. This is Wotan's Day. David Lane, rest in peace. Be back with you tomorrow on Thursday. Terrible Tommy is off and clear.
One with mercy. He was dead before he hit the floor. Who is he? Special Agent Terrence McGraw, counterintelligence unit out of Chicago, a special assignment for me. You ever hear of the group? No. They're a right-wing extremist cell. They're not your usual anti-government fringe types. They've got deep pockets and influence. McGraw was getting close to revealing their leadership when he was taken out. The only member we've been able to get a visual on is this guy. Goes by the name of Rodesky. McGraw had him pegged as the group spotter in charge of recruitment. They can afford the best, mostly freelancers. Combination of ex-CIA and DOD operatives and hitmen. So what do they want? Same as any terrorist group. Power. To what end, we don't know. What we do know is, before McGraw was killed, he had uncovered a plot to assassinate Senator Joseph Kaifman. That's the guy running for president. The one who will be president, if you believe the polls. Why Kaifman? McGraw couldn't provide any more details.
So what's your next move?
Nothing. I'm calling off the investigation. Come again?
That's right. As of today, the FBI is no longer investigating the group.
Okay, I don't get it.
You got a major conspiracy beef here. Not to mention a dead agent. And what, you want to back off?
Officially, yes. Unofficially. There's a reason why McGraw's cover was blown. He was betrayed by someone in the bureau.
What, like a mole?
I could be wrong. I hope I am. But if I'm not, there's no one I can trust anymore. Except you. I trust you because I knew your father.
I heard a rumor that there may be moles inside the FBI. Maybe lone wolf moles. And the ATF? Uh-huh. Well, could be. I don't know. Nobody tells me nothing.